From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! President Clinton meets with the Emir of Kuwait 5 years after the Gulf War. We'll talk about U.S. support for authoritarian rule in Kuwait.
In September 1992, all eyes were on the unfolding tragedy in the former Yugoslavia. But meanwhile, the Kuwaiti-U.S. plan to purge Kuwait of its pre-war Palestinian population was being carried forth swiftly and without mercy.
And signs of hope in an era of voter apathy. We'll talk to students about youth activism and voting.
We collectively together feel that young people have the idealism and vision to lead this country into the next century, and that we should be setting the example by voting.
That and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're here in the studios of KPFA, Pacifica Station out in Berkeley, California, as we are covering the Media and Democracy Congress that is happening today and tomorrow and throughout the weekend. On today's show, we begin with yesterday's visit by the Kuwaiti Emir with President Clinton in the White House. Today, former President Bush is meeting with the Emir. And then we're going to go to a national student conference that challenges the stereotypes of youth apathy and conservatism, and we'll be talking about the demonization of youth in the press. That's all coming up on Democracy Now! In 1991, Project Censored chose a journalist, Dennis Bernstein's story on casualties in the Gulf War, as the number one censored story of the year. 5 years later, that story remains underreported, as does much of what's going on in post-war Kuwait. We're joined right now by Dennis Bernstein in the studio. He's an associate editor with the Pacific News Service here in San Francisco and co-host of Flashpoints, a daily radio news magazine on Pacifica Station KPFA. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dennis.
Thanks, Amy. Welcome to the earthquake state.
Well, we've got a few things to talk about today. We want to begin with a story of what's going on in Kuwait and what it means for President Clinton and presidential candidate Bill Clinton to be meeting with the Emir. And then we want to go on with you to a story that you've been covering for years, and that's to the state of Arizona, where they just completed their Republican primary. We want to go to the border with you and another guest to talk about the militarization that is going on there that we saw not at all in the mainstream press this week, because that is a story of Arizona that you covered and followed the sanctuary movement. And to the studio, we can just touch on the story of Al D'Amato. Al D'Amato, the senator of New York, who is certainly a kingmaker and will be getting a lot of press in the next few days as we move into the New York primary. So that's what we're going to do here on this hour of Democracy Now! Let's begin with the Emir of Kuwait and his visit to the White House yesterday. Dennis, what is happening in Kuwait today?
Well, first of all, this is, as you point out, it's two presidents and two presidents in a row that have stood by this extreme authoritarian ruler in which rules Kuwait, in which women really don't have any rights. And if you don't live in Kuwait and you're not a Kuwaiti with roots back to the 1920s, you have no rights. Now, this is a story that really did not receive much coverage. You have Bill Clinton for the second time standing with the royal family. You'll remember back in 1993, Clinton responded to some unverified information from Kuwaiti sources that there was an assassination plot against George Bush. Bill Clinton bombed Baghdad at the time and actually killed the noted international painter, the Iraqi painter Laila al-Atir, who was known for painting extraordinary portraits of suffering of Palestinians, like at the various al-Sabah and al-Shatila camps. The idea that a democratic president who prides himself in believing in democracy would be with the Emir of Kuwait is unbelievable. What followed the so-called liberation of Kuwait was nothing short of a slaughter. Now, this sounds extreme, but let me give you some of the documentation from Amnesty International before we talk about who's really responsible for what happened. Amnesty International reported that there were 12 kinds of torture going on after the so-called liberation of Kuwait, torture being carried out by Kuwaiti security forces. Let me quote Amnesty International saying that this torture included savage beatings with sticks, hoses, pipes and rifle butts, whippings with electric cables, electric shocks, burning with cigarettes, candles, and acid, biting and threats of execution and sexual assault. And these torturers worked in tag teams. So the torture went on and on. One team would finish, the next team would come in and continue the torture. Now, this is extraordinary. The London Independent reporter Robert Fisk attempted to get this information out. He interviewed U.S. officials in Kuwait at the time and asked them about this assault that was going on against some 350,000 Palestinians who were in the country before the war. Most of them, by the way, supported the Kuwaiti resistance. Robert Fisk interviewed U.S. officials and said, "What about this torture? What about this slaughter? What about the purging of these Palestinians?" And he could not understand the U.S. official's response, which was virtually nil. What the U.S. official said is, "Yes, we have heard reports that these tortures were going on in police stations and schools around the country, but we didn't have the authority to intercede because while we could hear some of it from outside, we didn't have the right to go in and see what was happening to these people." What was happening was based on what was planned by the Kuwaitis and the United States government at the beginning of the war. There was a document that we got at the Pacific News Service, a Pentagon document prepared by the Pentagon and the Kuwaiti royal family that talked about the purge of the Palestinians, that they couldn't be trusted. They'd be referred to as stay-behind Palestinians as if they were working with the Iraqi resistance. There would be passes. There would be prison camps. All this came to pass, by the way, and the Palestinians were, in fact, purged from the country. They talked about how they had to purge the Palestinians from the banking system. The Palestinians were in charge, essentially. They were middle-level society in Kuwait. They were the bankers, the teachers, the doctors. This document with the Pentagon talked about how they had to change the currency and purge the Palestinians because they couldn't trust them. And what followed was this slaughter. These Palestinians were driven out of the country. First, they were abused. And we are talking about 12 different kinds of torture on the way to the border and no man's land.
I believe most of what we heard at that time was that the Kuwaiti family had returned and their first act was to install gold fixtures in the bathrooms. We didn't hear much about torture.
Well, now this, the Pentagon document, now this is what's very compelling. The Pentagon document showed how the U.S. government would monitor everything that happens in Kuwait, not only down to the gold toilet seats that would be replaced in the palace, but down to the amount of calories that each Kuwaiti citizen, I underline Kuwaiti citizen, because you had to be a Kuwaiti citizen back to 1920 to get this kind of support and help from the U.S. government, they would monitor everything. So when we talk about torture and this horrific situation and the purge of the Palestinians, we're talking about it all being monitored by the United States government. This is what we're talking about. This is what Robert Fisk attempted to report about and what we did at Pacific News Service. There was very little information coming out about this purge.
You know, Dennis, I know one of the stories you reported on was a family who came to this country, a Kuwaiti-Palestinian family, who had aided the Kuwaiti underground resistance during the time of the Iraqi occupation of Kuwait, but didn't fare too well when the Kuwaiti royal family returned.
Well, this is a story that crystallizes what the situation and the atmosphere was. Imagine, this is a Palestinian family. This is the Farhad family, and three members stayed in Kuwait during the occupation, and they risked their lives to support the Kuwaiti resistance. The father, in fact, was essentially a member of the Kuwaiti equivalent of the FBI as a Palestinian. He was a middle-level member. So this is somebody who worked for years with the Kuwaiti security forces. After the so-called liberation, Kuwaiti resistance came to the Farhat family house. They found out they were Palestinians. That's all they needed to know. They came into the house. There was the father, the daughter, and the son. They forced the son to shoot the father. Then they killed the father. Then they had the daughter prepare them coffee. They said, "Don't worry, you'll survive." After they raped her, they shot her in the head and left her for dead. But she survived. She says she survived because she was determined to tell this story of what happened. Now, you can imagine, Amy, if this happened to a family that whose the son literally went out and fought with the Kuwaiti resistance, the daughter went to the bank for hiding Kuwaitis to get money out of the bank because she was Palestinian, the father worked with the Kuwaiti security forces before the war, and this family was shot, killed, and left for dead, you can imagine what happened to your everyday Palestinian family.
And yesterday, of course, just to repeat one of the top stories, President Clinton met with the Kuwaiti emir in the White House. Now, this is exactly 5 years after the so-called liberation of Kuwait. And there was this five-year plan. So in a sense, that's supposed to be ending right now, isn't it? Where the U.S. is working as closely as it is with the royal family. So they must be now in the White House making plans for what is going to happen.
Well, the only thing that's going to end is the official U.S. involvement in Kuwait, which was made official according to this Pentagon document. But according to the document, many of the things that were put in place will be there forever. Now, there was another document that we got at the time, Amy, from the Kuwaiti pro-democracy movement. And they were planning to take this opening with the war to seize some more space for democracy. According to the document, the emir and the U.S. government had something different in mind. This document shows how the Kuwaitis were planning to purge even the minor changes that had happened towards democracy in Kuwait in the last 20 years. This and the Pentagon document talks about how there would, this is right in the document, it talks about how there would be the imposition of martial law, total press censorship, the banning of any criticism of the emir of Kuwait, that's still in place. You cannot write negatively about the emir in the various papers.
In Indonesia, it's called expressing enmity toward the state.
No enmity towards this state. And this went on and on. You could not, it provides for the ethnic cleansing. I mentioned the stay behind Palestinians. It talks in the document about the ID cards, about the prison camps. This policy, which was purged, put against the Palestinians to purge the Palestinians, is in place and has been in place to do it to the next group of people who came in to take the Palestinians' places. And by 1992, some 190,000 people had come from Pakistan and India to take the place of the Palestinians. In a few months, there was a report from Human Rights Watch about unbelievable abuses of the new population that had just come into Kuwait. We're talking about women who were being mass raped. When they complained, they would be thrown out of windows. When they went to the police station to report this, the police would call their owners, if you will. They were indentured servants or slaves. And the police would collaborate with the owners to suppress the Palestinians, not the Palestinians, the Pakistanians and the Indians, they would suppress their information. They would take their passports so they couldn't even communicate with the outside world about the abuses.
Dennis, there is a lot to talk about here, but we also wanted to do something else with you that you've been doing over the last few years, and that is talk about the militarization of the Arizona-Mexico border and then touch on Al D'Amato, the kingmaker in New York and around this country, who you've been doing a lot of work on, just came out with a piece published here in San Francisco. And we only have a few minutes to do all of that in. But before we go to all that, in a related story, something you've been investigating for a while, is the results of the Gulf War in terms of Persian Gulf War syndrome and what the soldiers, the U.S. soldiers, suffered there. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of where that stands today? And because this is an election show and President Clinton is a presidential candidate, where he fits into that picture?
Well, this is a story of the exportation of nuclear, chemical, and biological warfare agents, real intense chemistry used in warfare. Bill Clinton has been perhaps the most active in exporting this kind of technology. What happened during the Gulf War, it may have been the most toxic war in American history, where thousands, tens of thousands of soldiers, Allied soldiers, Iraqi soldiers, and many people living in the region were exposed to chemical and biological warfare agents. This is a story that has been suppressed substantially in this country by the current director of the Central Intelligence Agency, who used to be at the Pentagon.
John Deutsch.
John Deutsch. And this is a story about how the U.S. government continues to use this dangerous depleted uranium technology, chemistry in Bosnia, the very kinds of equipment that were used in Kuwait and Iraq that are making many U.S. soldiers and people around the world sick, is now being deployed in Bosnia. And nothing is being said about the dangers of this equipment and this chemistry.
Well, President Clinton, maybe at one point we're going to get to ask him some questions on the campaign trail. I don't believe there's much in the papers today about what is happening in Kuwait and the true aftermath of the war with Iraq when it comes to U.S. soldiers.
You know, 60,000 U.S. veterans have signed onto a federal registry complaining of serious sickness from being exposed to this weaponry, and they are being ignored.
We're talking to Dennis Bernstein. Dennis is an associate reporter and editor at Pacific News Service that's based here in San Francisco. It's a national news wire. And he's also co-host of Flashpoints, which is an hour news magazine at KPFA here in Berkeley, Pacifica's radio station, the founding radio station out here in Berkeley. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Now, Dennis, you are an investigative reporter who's been exploring a lot of areas, and one that I think I first came to know your work on was Arizona, when you were down there covering the sanctuary movement and the trials that were taking place there. And because the Arizona primary just finished up there, that's the Republican primary, next week, that's in two Saturdays, will be the Democratic primary in Arizona, we wanted to touch on something that the mainstream media is not looking at, and that is the militarization, the increasing militarization of the Arizona border, the border with Mexico. Now, we've heard a lot about Pat Buchanan's feelings about immigrants and his call for building a wall. But in fact, he is not the man in power today in the United States. President Clinton is, and we're talking about this militarization that's been going on today. Can you talk more about it and introduce our guest who you've worked with in Arizona?
Okay, well, to contextualize, Amy, this current militarization grew out of the Reagan administration with Oliver North's attempt to suppress the sanctuary movement. This is a movement was called the Modern Underground Railroad to help torture victims and victims of war, wars happening in Central America, in El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua. I went down there to cover the Tucson Sanctuary trial, which was the arrest of a dozen priests, nuns, church workers, who were helping these victims. And the first day I was in the courtroom, a Vietnam veteran, actually a veteran of World War II, a liberator of concentration camps, stood up. His name was Duncan Murphy, and slapped his hands, his red, bloody hands, on the walls of the courtroom to protest the treatment the U.S. government was bringing upon Salvadorans and Guatemalans. He was comparing it to what he saw in World War II. It was very intense, political. The INS was bugging churches. They were in parking lots. It wasn't unusual to see these agents taking down license plate numbers. They were infiltrating Bible study meetings and prayer meetings to sort of nail the sanctuary movement. They were calling them slave traders. They were equating them to the coyotes who would bring many Mexicans and Central Americans into the country to do slave labor for the big farms. This was the beginning of the militarization of the border. This is where our guest Isabel Garcia comes into the picture, trying to advocate for immigrants' rights at the border, and she has done a lot to call attention to the extreme militarization of the border that's been going on since that trial.
We're going to break, and then we're going to go to Isabel Garcia, who is in Tucson, who's been doing this work for more than a decade now. Dennis, we want to thank you for joining us, and do stay with us. After we speak with Isabel Garcia and then talk a bit about D'Amato, we're going to move on to the youth vote. We're going to talk about youth apathy and not so apathy, youth not being so apathetic. And then we're going to be joined by a group of young people who will talk about how they're portrayed in the media and what their plans are for this election year. You're listening to Democracy Now! ¶¶ You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up, young people talking about their own lives rather than how they're characterized in the media and in this society. But right now, we're talking about Arizona, a story that we didn't hear anything about this week as the Republican primary was taking place. We're joined by Dennis Bernstein, Pacific News Service Associate Editor and also KPFA producer here in Berkeley. And we're joined on the telephone from Tucson by Isabel Garcia, who is a legal defender in Pima County in Tucson, which is the equivalent of a public defender.
Isabel, this is Dennis Bernstein with Amy here. You were there 15 years ago when the beginning of the sanctuary movement started. You were there when that young Salvadoran woman in 1981 showed up in your town with a bullet in her chest, and you began to advocate for these Central Americans. You were there in the Tucson courtroom, and you're there now. Could you talk about the militarization of the border region of southern Arizona since that trial?
Yes, I would have to say that the militarization, however, is going on throughout the southern border. But, of course, we monitor the situation regarding human rights of the Arizona border. And we have seen a dramatic increase, not only, of course, in budget allocations to enforcement and such, and all of it going to the southern border, but we see the actual militarization with our own eyes. Without even looking at Tim Dunn's pioneering study about the militarization, we have been witnesses to the growing militarization of a border between two supposedly good friends and good neighbors. And, of course, with an area that has much history that we really can't go into right now. But we have seen since the sanctuary trial, we have seen year after year a growing militarization in the form of not only more Border Patrol agents, but we have seen the involvement of other sectors of law enforcement and even now the Department of Defense in regard to monitoring the border. We have seen...
Talk about the human rights violations. You talk about hundreds of violations. You talk about serious abuses. Talk about how the INS is treating people with darker skin.
Yes, our communities are basically under attack. I would venture to say it's generally almost a police state in some of our areas. Most folks are used to having the involvement of their metropolitan police department, maybe even their sheriff. But when you live at the border, you have in your midst, you have U.S. Customs, you have Border Patrol, you have DEA, INS inspectors, ATF officials, the local sheriff, the local police department, and now we have elements of the Department of Defense. So what we have found is that our communities are basically living in a deconstitutionalized zone. We don't have constitutional rights to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. That's the most common, of course, and least egregious of all of the violations, and that is we are stopped now because of the color of our skin. We're stopped by all law enforcement, doesn't matter who it is, and they're enforcing immigration laws and demanding to see our paperwork. It's a little bit like apartheid, where you had to have your little pass or what have you, and this is happening on a daily basis. Of course, people are also insulted, screamed at. They're divided. Their families are divided with screaming children on one side and parents on the other. They put dogs to our persons and our cars trying to sniff out drugs or what have you. They tear up people's local crossing cards and immigration cards. They take away driver's license. They beat people up. They shoot people. They rape women.
And this has been documented also by Human Rights Watch. Talk about, you were an attorney. You attempted to prosecute or to help bring to justice Michael Elmer, who was abusing Dario Miranda and that family. Talk about how Elmer was allowed to operate with impunity and how this represents the kind of treatment you're talking about here.
Yes. June the 12th of 1992, Michael Elmer, a Border Patrol agent, shot and killed Dario Miranda, and he shot him in the back. He shot him twice. He shot 6 or 8 rounds and shot him twice in the back as Darío Miranda was fleeing back to Mexico. We were in the immigrant rights community, those of us that advocate for immigrant rights, we thought we had gained quite a victory because we were able to get first-degree murder charges against Darío Miranda. The local county attorney, also a Hispanic, and of course, you know, he's been involved in all of our campaigns in the past to bring these issues to light. They actually brought first-degree murder charges against Michael Elmer. This made history, United States history, although it's not the first time Border Patrol agents have killed immigrants, it's the first time that one had been charged for first-degree murder. And he was acquitted. He was acquitted in the state courts, and then in spite of the incredible evidence that was presented to a jury, including that he had been shooting at other people, at other groups of Mexicans in the past, he was allowed to walk free. Those of us in this community were outraged. We demanded federal civil rights charges similar to Rodney King because we figured this was the Rodney King of the border. This was the Rodney King case of the Latino community in this country, where a man died at his hands. And so we agitated and were able to get federal civil rights charges. Again, an all-white jury acquitted Michael Elmer. And it's very clear that the people in those juries acquitted him because of the poisoning that our public has gone through in regards to immigrants, that basically Darío Miranda brought on his own death by crossing into this country illegally.
Isabel Garcia, we only have a minute or so left. Could you just briefly talk about Task Force 6? You know, people are talking about, Lamar Alexander is saying we need another branch of the armed forces to guard the border. Buchanan says electric fence. Talk about Task Force 6 and these mock exercises which the joint military prepares for an invasion from Mexico.
Yes, this is probably one of the most frightening aspects of what's happened lately, and that is the involvement of the Department of Defense, who had, in the past, the military had not wanted to become involved in the enforcement of civil law because they're trained to kill. Now we have the Department of Defense very intimately involved in the border, and with, of course, Lamar Alexander and others clamoring for their participation at the border. It is coming in the form of Joint Task Force 6 at this time that's based outside of El Paso in Texas. And that is a police now, basically a task force that combines the forces of the military, U.S. Customs, Border Patrol, DEA, ATF, and all of the local law enforcement. It's a very dangerous development for our community because we know that, in fact, the involvement of the military can spell nothing but trouble for us. We have seen in their documentation that they do plan, and they are going forward with a plan of low-intensity conflict, which was practiced, begun in Vietnam wars, and then in the wars in Central America, where it's a low-intensity warfare on the population with one element trying to win hearts and minds. And we've seen an example of that, too. We had a Border Patrol helicopter in Christmas coming down with a Santa Claus giving gifts to these children, when we know that it's these very people that violate human rights and separate families on a daily basis. They have been given, the Border Patrol has been giving all this training by the military. They are there as advisors, supposedly will not engage at all unless they're fired upon. And let me tell you, the Marines have already done a shootout in December of 89 here in Nogales, Arizona. Nogales, Arizona was also the location where they established a mock detention camp. And in this mock detention camp, what they did was practice for the potential of an invasion, supposedly, of people running away from Mexico. And this is where we would detain human beings. We are building walls. They want a triple fences along San Diego. Here in Nogales, they have put steel matting on the wall. And, of course, they have all of the equipment, night sensors, the infrared sensors and the firepower that you would not imagine, that local law enforcement agents cannot possess probably ever unless they're in a specialized unit. All of the Border Patrol agents possess this firepower. The trial of Michael Elmer was very, very significant in that in the court of law, these agents had to testify about the massive violations of regulations and of law that were practiced just on that one evening. And these are gentlemen, some of them, that are trafficking in drugs. Michael Elmer was trafficking in drugs at the time, as well as those of his other unit. And this was not allowed by the court to surface to this jury. They tried to make Darío Miranda a drug trafficker because he wasn't carrying drugs, so supposedly he was a scout. So it's a catch-22. If you're carrying drugs, it's because you're a drug trafficker, and if you're not, it's because you're a scout. And the jury was fed all of the negative stereotypes and all of the misinformation about immigrants, and as a result, he was released.
Isabel Garcia, we do have to wrap up, and we just have about 15 seconds, but back to the primary, I just wanted to sum up with this. You're describing a very extreme situation, which is under a Democratic administration. You just experienced the Republican primary, where there was a lot of rhetoric, very fierce, against immigrants. Does that have an effect in Arizona as they leave and you have to continue to live there? Or considering the situation, is it just really a drop in the bucket?
No, the heated rhetoric is going to hurt us for a long time, just like the passing of 187 has hurt us here in Arizona. There's no way that we can escape the net effect of what they leave after they leave our state. And I believe that we are going to see more and more violations of human rights of our community.
Isabel Garcia, we want to thank you very much for joining us from Tucson. Isabel Garcia, a legal defender in Pima County, Tucson, which is the equivalent of a public defender. We thank you very much for joining us on Democracy Now! Next Saturday, not this coming Saturday, but next Saturday is the Democratic primary in Arizona. It won't get as much attention because Bill Clinton is the only major candidate in terms of who the press recognizes as running for president. Now, we're going to be moving on to the youth vote and then youth activism in this area in California and how young people are using the media, our columnists and local papers, and are using the radio. But in our last minute remaining, I wanted to go back to you, Dennis Bernstein, and talk about the piece you had this week in the San Francisco Chronicle. Since we just have
the San Francisco Bay Guardian.
Sorry, I'm coming in from out of town. And since we just have a minute, we want to have you back next week as we move into the New York primary to really describe the politics of Senator Alphonse D'Amato, the Republican senator from New York. But give us a taste of King Alphonse, the name of your piece.
Well, this is about Alphonse D'Amato, who is the money behind Bob Dole. He's also the money behind the Republican Senate's push to take over, to have a veto-proof majority in the Senate. Alphonse D'Amato may very well be the dirtiest politician that ever served in Congress, at least the top 10. This is somebody who was in bed with Michael Milken and has links to three organized crime families, appeared as a character witness for a mafioso captain, and tried to intercede on behalf of a mafioso godfather with the U.S. attorney in New York. This is Alphonse D'Amato.
In fact, that U.S. attorney is the current mayor of New York,
isn't he? Wonder why he's the only person in New York State that doesn't support Bob Dole and Alphonse D'Amato.
So this is Alphonse D'Amato, who we do not hear much about. He has, as you said, he is the support behind Bob Dole in New York.
He's also the lightning rod for the Senate on Whitewater. The idea that this guy is the purveyor of ethics around SNLs, when he, along with Michael Milken, opened up the SNLs to junk bonds, is unbelievable.
And Dennis, you have your own personal story, having worked for Alphonse D'Amato when he was Hempstead's supervisor out in Long Island. Quite an interesting story that almost went to court, but we'll talk about that more next week. Dennis, we want to thank you for joining us for this segment of Democracy Now! Dennis Bernstein, associate editor with Pacific News Service here in California, and also the co-host of Flashpoint, a radio news magazine that is heard daily on Pacifica Station KPFA. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Amy.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to move right into our youth segment, something we've been wanting to do for a while now. While some may perceive American college campuses in the 90s as being apathetic at best and conservative at worst, a national student conference was recently held at Harvard University to kick off a year-long effort to get young people involved in the political process. Chuck Rosina of WMBR in Cambridge files this report.
On the weekend before the New Hampshire primary, over 1,000 young people from around the country came to a Youth Vote 96 kickoff campaign at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Youth Vote 96 is a nonpartisan coalition dedicated to increasing youth voter participation in this year's election. Therese Helizar is director of Campus Green Vote and one of the organizers of this conference.
We collectively together feel that young people have the idealism and vision to lead this country into the next century, and that we should be setting the example by voting. I mean, a lot of nations look at Americans and can't believe that we're not using our most basic democratic right and voting. And young people will really be setting the standard, I believe, in this next election cycle, that we should be getting out there and voting in record numbers. And Youth Vote 96 actually has a goal of getting about 50% of young people to the polls. And so I think that this year will be totally different than other presidential election years and will be a historical one for young people.
Therese Helizar cites motor voter laws and young people's use of the internet as reasons for her optimism. Motor voter made it easier for young Americans to register, and the internet has become a vast organizing tool. 1996 marks the 25th anniversary of the Constitutional Amendment granting 18-year-olds the right to vote. Few college-age Americans these days are aware that their voting rights are relatively new and resulted from student struggles during the Vietnam War. Kapona Christie Murphy, a student and environmental activist from Oregon, explains what motivated her to travel all the way to Cambridge, Massachusetts to attend this conference.
I think what this conference is trying to do is amazing, and building power and registering students to vote is something that is critical to the student movement, and what we're trying to do here is make sure that students have the training to go ahead and be effective in organizing their campuses and organizing their communities.
And what issues are you concerned about mostly?
Personally, I'm really concerned about the environment and issues of hunger and homelessness. But the conference covers a huge range of issues, ranging from the deficit to environment to how to get media on your campus. So it combines skills and issues and will train students on the things that they need to know about to run very effective voter registration and get out the vote campaigns.
Issues and strategies seem to be the driving force of this conference, with partisan politics taking a back seat. Jed Weiss, a sophomore from Harvard University, tells why he thinks this is.
I think a lot of concern about student aid. There have been bills proposed in the Congress that have proposed dramatic cuts in student aid, and I think that's an issue that really strikes home with most students here. Even Republican students tend to object to cuts in student aid. Just because you're Republican doesn't mean you agree with every bill coming out of the Republican Congress. A lot of Republican friends of mine remain staunch Republicans, but they're outraged by some of the cuts in student funding that are being proposed.
So these would be three kinds of coalitions. The Youth Vote Coalition.
Some workshops, like this one entitled Coalitions, the Building Blocks of a Movement, were aimed at showing students from diverse political affiliations how they can find common ground and work together.
In most cases, the coalitions that you form, a sort of a local Youth Vote Coalition, will be a coordinating coalition. You don't have to agree on everything, but you're agreeing that you have a common goal in registering young people to vote, and that you're going to coordinate your resources so that you're not duplicating your efforts, so that you're reaching as broad a group of people as possible. But there's still flexibility within each organization to take the approach that they think is best.
Hi, where are you from?
Boston.
And what brings you to this conference?
I'm a student at Northeastern University, and I'm very political and very active on my campus and my community, and I just feel anything that will get young people more active in their communities, whether it be politically or otherwise, is good. And so that's why I'm here. I'm here learning how I can bring this stuff back to my university, my community, and make more people get involved.
Have you found it worthwhile?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this is fun for me. This is like going to a party. I mean, it's just really exciting. It's really exciting to see all these young people here that are involved in positive things. Like, at your own university, you won't see this many people like this doing things like this, so it's just really encourages you to go back to school and keep on in the activities. So it's been great for me.
Claude Sneed of Northeastern University. Youth Vote organizers are hoping to mobilize 12 million people to the polls in November. The determination and desire for positive change expressed by these students made it clear that they are a voting bloc that will have to be reckoned with. It was also obvious that political activism on American college campuses is still alive and well. Again, Therese Helenzar of Campus Green Vote.
It's really exciting to see all these young people here. For me, you know, having done this work for the past several years, it's always wonderful to share my vision and hear other people's vision and really get a shot in the arm to continue to do this work.
For Pacifica Radio, this is Chuck Rosina reporting from Harvard University.
And coming up after this break, we're joined by a number of young people in the studio to talk about their lives. You're listening to Democracy Now! You are listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's national grassroots daily election show. And if you have friends around the country who do not get to hear Democracy Now!, tell them to call their community or public radio station and ask them for Pacifica's Democracy Now! For copies of any tape of any show, including today's, you can call our archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to comment on the show or give us some tips and news, ideas, whatever, you can contact us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Now, we're here in California, usually broadcasting out of Washington, next week broadcasting out of New York, for the Media and Democracy Congress that's taking place here. More than 600 activists and journalists and internet users are gathering in San Francisco and Japantown to talk about media, to talk about democracy, the kinds of things we talk about every day. And tomorrow we're going to be bringing you Chuck Lewis, who is head of the Center for Public Integrity, talking about the buying of the president. We're going to be talking about money in politics and voting, something that certainly makes people angry, makes people, I believe, apathetic, feel that they can't influence the process. We've got a group of young people in the studio right now who feel like they can make a difference, and they are making a difference. And we want to welcome you all to Democracy Now! We're joined by Lynn Duff, who is a youth correspondent with Pacific News Service, also works with Pacifica's KPFA Flashpoint. She's an intern with that program. And she also has a column that has appeared in the San Francisco Examiner. Every Tuesday, the San Francisco Examiner runs a column called Youth Outlook, or YO, and a number of young people have been able to contribute to that. We're also joined by Dana King and J.R. Valerie. Dana King is a high school student at College Prep in Oakland, and J.R. Valerie is a 17-year-old high school student at St. Joseph's in Alameda. He comes from Oakland, and they're both involved with something called Youth Radio, and we welcome you all to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with Dana? What is Youth Radio?
Youth Radio is a broadcasting and journalism program for youth. It's a free program that teaches youth basically the basic radio skills: how to DJ, how to produce pieces, how to just basic skills in radio. And from there, they try to get students involved in the program. They try to get them internships at other radio stations.
And what do you do with Youth Radio?
Well, right now, I'm a commentary writer. I just had a commentary on NPR, and yesterday I just filmed my commentary for a teen show that we have here called First Cut. So I graduated from the program, and I'm still trying to stay hooked up with them a little bit. They're helping me get my voice on the airwaves, but I don't have like a definite role with them right now.
Tell us about the commentary you did for National Public Radio.
Oh, it was about, well, I've done two. I have another one coming up March 8th. I don't know if it's going to be on National Public Radio, but it's going to be on a local public station. But one was just about my point of view as a woman and how it feels to walk down the street and be looked at by men, and how I feel like that's to a certain extent an assault. And another one was just about being biracial. So you can really write about a lot of different things, about your perspective.
What did you say about being biracial?
Well, I was talking about how I didn't like people asking me all the time what I was. And so it was basically just about how I learned to do it. It was about my finding a definition for my who I was racially, and also about my finding a way of dealing with people when they would ask me that question.
What do you say?
I say I'm mixed, or I say I'm Dana King, or I say it depends, but it depends on how well I know the person. But if it's I don't know the person and they ask me something like that, I usually say, well, it's not really any of your business.
You know, when a baby is first born, the first question is it a boy or is it a girl? Do you feel race is a defining question in this society?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a kind of naive question, actually, because it seems so obvious that race is a defining factor in the society. All you have to do is walk through any city and see where white people live, where black people live, where Latino people live. Everybody lives in a different place. Everybody goes to school in different places. It seems to me like it's pretty obviously a defining factor in our society of who you're going to be, where you're going to live, who you're going to associate with. Uh-huh.
Do you feel in the presidential election, the campaign that is going on now for a year, do you feel like it is a major issue when it's talked about and even when it's not?
Yeah, I definitely feel it's a major issue, because especially right now when they're trying to cut out affirmative action and a lot of minority rights programs or programs to help minorities get a foot into the door of the power structure. So yeah, I feel when they discuss it, I feel most often now that minority rights are being attacked, and so I feel as I guess a youth of color that this election is very important in terms of I want to make sure that someone who is for minority programs and minority rights and minority protections gets into office. And that's this is going to be the first time I ever vote. So this is definitely an important election for me, because as someone who's kind of joining the world, I'm going to turn 18, I'm going to be an adult, and who's going to be an adult citizen for the first time, it's important to me that I join a world where my rights are protected and where I can go to any kind of job location and feel that if I'm qualified, I'll definitely have equal opportunity to get in there.
Do you feel like your vote can make a difference?
Yes. Yeah, I think that this is, it seems to me like this is going to be a close election. There's so many, I know there are a lot of Clinton supporters, I'm a Clinton supporter, but it seems like there are also this kind of new batch of voters, this Christian coalition and all these pro-life people, and it seems like it's going to be a real fight to see which side wins. And I think, yeah, my vote will make a big difference. One more person supporting righteous people.
You're listening to Dana King, who is a high school student here in Oakland and part of a project called Youth Radio. J.R. Valerie is also a part of Youth Radio. When is your show, J.R.?
Well, Youth Radio goes on the air every Friday from 7 to 9.
At night?
At night.
And what do you do on Youth Radio?
Well, right now, I just graduated from the program with Dana. Right now, I'm hooked up with an internship at another radio station where Youth Radio actually handles the production of it. So I basically do that, and then I do a lot of peer teaching.
What do you mean peer teaching?
Like, well, some students will have new students coming in, and we have like digital editing classes and stuff like that that's going on right now. And I do teaching as far as I'll teach students how to edit, I'll teach students how to do production and stuff like that.
What difference has radio made in your life?
Well, I think radio as well as newspaper, because I also work for Pacific News Service. I think they have both given me a voice in the media to say what I want to say and give my viewpoint and my community's viewpoint.
What do you feel that the media is missing? What voice, what unique voice are you bringing to the whole discussion?
I'm bringing the voice of, I think that I'm bringing the voice of basically youth of color as a male.
Let me ask you this. Okay. Why don't we be very specific? When you work for Pacific News Service, what have you written about?
I've written about affirmative action. I've written about the death penalty. I've covered a lot of social
issues.
What do you
feel about the death penalty?
I feel that it should be abolished because, it's not applied equally. And then I don't understand how you teach someone not to murder or kill by killing them.
You have a number of people on death row here in California. You also have this Maxi prison at Pelicans Bay, something that we even hear about on the East Coast, quite something. And the prison guard lobby here, the second most powerful lobby in the state, and a very, very healthy, or some might say unhealthy, vast growing prison industry here, the prison building industry.
Thanks to Pete Wilson.
Let's talk to Lynn and go back to JR. Lynn, you are with Pacific News Service also. Your column has appeared in the San Francisco Examiner as well. What have you written about?
I've written about a lot of different things. Everything from being on food stamps to I recently came back from Haiti and interviewed President Aristide. What I think is really important is that we have a say in the media and in things that are written in the media, because if you read the newspaper, most of the articles, even the articles about young people, they don't quote us. They don't talk to us. They talk to probation officers, to judges, to lawyers, to parents, to teachers. But how often do you see a young person themselves quoted if they haven't been a victim of a crime? It's never. And the way that they portray us is as gang members, as criminals, as dangerous. They're really, I think, contributing to the whole move to criminalize and demonize young people in this society.
Now, there's actually going to be a protest here today at, 5 o'clock. And it involves a young person. Can you tell us that? It's a story you've been covering.
There is a young girl, a 16-year-old, who was out past curfew, and her mother called the police and had the police pick her up because she was concerned about her daughter, as any parent would be. And the police took her to the Youth Guidance Center, which is the juvenile hall in San Francisco, and she refused to be strip searched in front of two men. And because she refused to be strip searched, one man held her down on the ground.
These were male guards?
These were male guards, yeah. One man held her down on the ground, and four women tore her clothes off while the other male supervisor watched from the doorway. And then the man picked up her legs and looked between them. And it's something that happens a lot to young people. There isn't really a lot of respect for us in society as a whole. And this whole policy with strip searching is that when it came out in the papers, Ed Flowers, the head of Youth Guidance Center, was saying, well, I don't know if there's really anything the matter with it. But if it had happened to an adult female prisoner, there would have been outrage. It would have been totally inappropriate. It would have been against the law. But because it happened to a young person, it's suddenly a question of, well, I don't know if it's really, against policy or not. So there's a protest today at 5 o'clock at the Youth Guidance Center, which is 375 Woodside, across from McAteer High School at the corner of Patola. And it's called by Youth Uprisings Coalition.
Have you gotten a chance to write about this in the San Francisco Examiner?
Not yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're also involved with the community organizing team of Berkeley Oakland Support Services. Can you tell us about what that is and how it fits into the election?
Well, it's a new project by Berkeley Oakland Support Services to start a youth program. And really, it's because so many of the issues coming up in the elections and coming up now with three strikes and all the student walkouts have been directly affecting youth. And although most youth aren't old enough to vote, obviously, or don't qualify because for whatever reasons, because they're immigrants or because they're convicted felons or whatever, that we really need to have a say in the way things are happening. And also we have to, young people don't vote. And I know they talk a lot about youth apathy. And I think that's really comes from a perspective that voting doesn't change anything. And it's true that voting might not change, probably won't change the systematic reasons for young people being oppressed and for the attacks on affirmative action and the attacks on youth and immigrants and women's rights. But what they can do is at least you can at least say no to propositions. You can at least say, no, I don't accept three strikes. No, I don't accept this. And so we're really trying to encourage young people to vote as a tactic for social change. And also for youth to get involved in the election time issues and fighting for increase in the minimum wage and fighting for more rights for homeless people in Oakland. We're trying to get a children's trust, which would guarantee funding for youth programs.
You yourself were homeless, is that right?
Yeah, I was homeless for most of my adolescence.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up, and I hope that we can continue this discussion over time. We're going to be here through the election, and we'd like to have you back to talk about your reaction to different issues. JR, you are 17. Are you going to be old enough to vote in November?
Yes.
Are you planning to?
I turn 18 in April. Yes, I do plan to vote.
Is it something you look forward to? Does it matter to you?
Yes, I think it does matter. I think, just like Dana said, it's one more vote behind that which you believe.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for joining us, and I hope that you're going to be offering us some commentaries on Democracy Now! We've been joined by Dana King, who's a high school student in Oakland, and you sound a lot older than that, I'll tell you. J.R. Valerie, student at St. Joe's High School in Alameda. And I want to thank Lynn Duff, a youth correspondent with Pacific News Service and an intern here at Flashpoint at KPFA, and part of the community organizing team of Berkeley Oakland Support Services. Again, for our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this show, Democracy Now!, or any show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can contact us, comment, whatever. If you'd like to send a letter to one of the young people who we're talking to today, we can pass it on. You can send us email, democracy@pacifica.org. Our address again, democracy@pacifica.org. And again, we're here for the Media and Democracy Congress. I'm glad that's given us an excuse to get to meet you in person. We'll be going back to Washington next week and then to New York. So we do hope you will all stay with us and urge stations around the country to run Democracy Now! Well, that's it for another edition of this program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. Today's program was engineered by Michael Yoshida at the studios of Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. I'm Amy Goodman. Have a good day.